had. It seemed wrong that someone could die in such a mundane way. A heart attack while driving, sitting for hours strapped into a car seat surrounded only by people whose job it was to see to it that she was examined, investigated, photographed, documented, and carted away in a van to be taken to a morgue. Judy guessed that there would have to be an autopsy because it was an unattended death, and somehow that made it worse, that in a few hours, or maybe even the next day, another stranger would invade the very corpus, slice a Y incision into her chest, then extract, examine, measure, and weigh her organs, record her demise in triplicate, and issue a death certificate. They reached the point directly across from the Honda so that they were lined up with a clear view of the front seat. They stopped, and Aunt Barb's attention riveted on the Honda, where silhouettes were still moving around inside the car. There did appear to be a figure in the front seat, but it was too far away to see clearly, for which Judy was secretly grateful. Aunt Barb craned her neck, standing on tiptoe. "What's going on, officer? What are they doing in there?" "That would be the coroner and the deputy coroner performing the last stages of their investigation. They and the evidence technicians examine the body and make sure it gets photographed the way it was found." Officer Hoffman gestured to the group of police officers. "The department already has uniformed officers interviewing neighbors to see if they saw the vehicle pull over or anything else unusual or out of the ordinary. We ask them if they know the deceased or recognize the vehicle and if they've had any strange events in the area." Aunt Barb frowned, but didn't look away from the Honda. "There are no neighbors." Judy nodded. "And it's not as if it's a crime scene."
"No matter, crime scene or no," Officer Hoffman shrugged in his heavy windbreaker. "We follow the same procedure. It's an apparently natural death, but we still investigate as if it's a crime scene. An assistant from the DA's office is here, and so are two of the county detectives."
Judy eyed the clump of men. "Are the detectives the ones in suits and ties?"
"Yes. In addition to the interviews, we have uniformed officers patrolling the perimeter, looking for anything suspicious or out of the ordinary on the ground, near the vehicle, or even in the hayfield."
Aunt Barb shivered slightly, her eyes glued to the Honda. Grief etched lines into the pale skin of her face, stretched thin across her gaunt cheekbones. The tip of her nose was turning red, though it wasn't that cold. Judy talked to fill in the silences, her mother's daughter.
"Officer Hoffman, do you do anything differently in terms of your investigation if the deceased is undocumented?"
"No," Officer Hoffman answered. "We do everything by the book. For example, we had an aggravated robbery last week of an undocumented worker, which unfortunately happens a lot since they get paid in cash. We investigated and prosecuted that case the same as if that person were a citizen. We have to. Same difference if we arrest an undocumented person or if an undocumented person is our suspect. We Mirandize them, and he's entitled to the same free lawyer as a citizen."
Judy had no idea.
"If you were to ascertain that someone you arrest or a victim was undocumented, what are your obligations to the immigration services at the federal level? Do you have to report to them?"
Officer Hoffman's blue-eyed gaze shifted slyly to her. "You're talking like a lawyer. Are you a lawyer?"
"I am," Judy smiled. "Does it show?"
"Luckily, no." Officer Hoffman permitted himself a tight smile. "Anyway, in answer to your question, I don't know if we legally have to notify the feds, but we do. It's not our first priority, but the chief will probably contact ICE tomorrow."
"What's ICE?" Judy asked.
"Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We have a small police force in East Grove, only 8 uniformed officers, 3 evidence techs, and the chief."
"But it's fairly safe out here, isn't it?"
Officer Hoffman nodded. "Yes. The main issue in the undocumented community is robbery and theft. They can't use the banks and are always taking cash to Western Union to be wired home. You ask me, Western Union would be out of business but for them."
Officer Hoffman surveyed the scene.
"It will take us a few more hours to process here. We'll probably release it tomorrow. We lucked out in that this isn't a busy road."
Meantime, Aunt Barb had fallen into a grave silence, still fixed on the Honda.
"It looks like the window is down in the front seat, doesn't it, officer?"
Officer Hoffman squinted.
"Yes, it does."
Judy looked, too.
"Did the coroner do that? Or the evidence techs?"
Officer Hoffman shook his head. "No, we leave everything untouched, everything exactly the way it was found."
Aunt Barb was shaking her head.
Iris doesn't drive with the window open. Even on a nice day, she doesn't like her hair to blow around, and I can't understand why she's on this road at all. Judy asked, is it on the way home for her from work? No, not at all. Aunt Barb kept her eyes trained on the Honda. It's a straight shot from where she works to her apartment. So if she felt nauseated at work and decided to go home, she wouldn't take this way. This is like the hypotenuse to the triangle. It would add 20 minutes to the trip. Also, remember that call she got before she left today? I wonder where her phone is. Hold on. Officer Hoffman motioned to the coroner's van, where there was new activity. Two young men in black uniforms emerged from the back of the van with a stretcher and carried it toward the Honda. The coroner's office is getting ready to take her now. Some of the big departments have stand-up screens that you can put up so that nobody can see anything. We don't have the budget for that. Judy put her arm around her aunt. Aunt Barb, you want to go back to the car? No, thanks. Aunt Barb formed praying hands, which she pressed to her lips. Uniformed personnel climbed out of the Honda's front seat, and others arrived to help. Their bodies made a crowd of dark silhouettes around the car, blocking Judy's and Aunt Barb's views. But in the next moment, two men in black uniforms lifted a body from the front seat. Then it disappeared from view again, as they must have put it on the stretcher. Judy couldn't see the body and was sure her aunt couldn't either. She looked over to check. But before she knew what was happening, Aunt Barb had slid out from under her arm and was charging forward, bolting between the flares, through the perimeter and toward the Honda. Miss, please stop! Officer Hoffman called out, giving chase. Chapter 7 Aunt Barb! Judy caught her aunt by the elbow just as she almost stumbled on an electrical cord from the Klieg lights, which blasted the area around the stretcher with light. The crowd of police personnel turned around at the commotion, and the Klieg lights made harsh, contrasting shadows on their faces. Their expressions looked collectively disapproving. Judy looked past them, stricken. Iris was laying on the stretcher, inside a black vinyl body bag that had yet to be zipped, its sides gaping open. Her eyes remained closed, but her head was to the side, showing her ear and the gold crucifix earrings. Her hands were resting together on her body, but oddly it looked as if one or two of her nails had been broken, the red polish chipped off, and some of the rhinestones missing. "Oh, Iris, no!" her aunt cried out, collapsing, and Judy grabbed her, hugged her close, and moved her away from the sight. "Aunt Barb, come with me. I'm sorry, so sorry." Officer Hoffman took her aunt's other arm gently. "Ladies, you must exit the perimeter." "No, no, no." Aunt Barb sobbed, hanging her head, sagging between the policeman and Judy, and letting them lead her away from the stretcher and back to the Volkswagen, where they eased her, sobbing, into the passenger seat and closed the door behind her. Judy faced Officer Hoffman. "I'm sorry that happened. I didn't see that coming, but I should have." "No need to apologize," Officer Hoffman nodded sympathetic. "You never know how people are going to react in a situation like this. That's why we do death notifications in pairs, and why we always make sure that the next of kin is sitting down when we do the notification. I've had the craziest things happen during a notification. One time, I told a man that his son had been killed in an auto accident, and the man jumped up from the couch and ran clear out of the house. We had to chase him down the street." "Oh my," Judy said, thinking that being a policeman had to be one of the most demanding jobs on the planet. "So, thank you for your cooperation. I'll make a note that your aunt made a personal identification." "I have one question before we go." Judy couldn't get Iris's broken fingernails out of her mind for some reason. "What happens next to the body? Will there be an autopsy?"
"Yes. Since the new DA, we always autopsy after an auto accident to find out if there was a medical event."
"How long would that take and who would get the results?"
Let's see. It's Saturday night, so I bet the autopsy would be Sunday or Monday. They would release the body probably on Tuesday to the funeral home that would be picked out by whoever claims it."
Judy thought ahead. "That might be my aunt, but I will do the arranging."
"If she claims the body, she would be responsible for the expenses at the morgue. If the body were unclaimed, then it would be cremated at the county's expense."
Officer Hoffman took a step closer. You didn't hear this from me, but we have a real problem with the undocumented bodies. The families know that if the body is unclaimed, we'll cremate it at the taxpayer expense. So they wait to claim the body, let the county cremate it, then claim it.
Judy's thoughts were stuck on Iris. What if she didn't die of natural causes? What if there's something suspicious about the death?
She gestured at the guys and ties.
Can I talk to the detective on the case?
Sure, I'll go get him. Stay here.
Officer Hoffman turned and jogged off toward the group, and Judy opened the car door and leaned into her aunt.
I'm so sorry, Aunt Barb. How are you?
It's just so sad.
Aunt Barb had stopped crying, but her eyes were filmed and bloodshot, and her knit cap tilted askew. She slumped in her too big parka, wiping her eyes with a balled-up Kleenex.
Do you feel up to seeing the detective on her case?
Officer Hoffman went to get him, and I can talk with him alone or with you.
Let's do it. It's important.
Her aunt dabbed at her eyes again.
I'll stay in the car, though. I feel tired.
Of course. Judy straightened up, left the passenger door open, and turned around to see Officer Hoffman approaching them with a man about 6 feet tall, with a bulky build, short hair, wire-rimmed aviator glasses, and crow's feet that placed him in his mid-40s. She put on a professional smile, which was another thing she hadn't learned in law school. Officer Hoffman gestured at the detective.
Miss Carrier, this is Detective Raymond Boone. He's assigned to the case, and I'll take my leave now. Nice meeting you and your aunt.
Thanks, Judy waved to him as he left, and Detective Boone extended a hammy hand.
Miss Carrier, I'm pleased to meet you. Thank you for coming out to make the identification.
Thanks for your help. Judy accepted his handshake, firm enough to make her glad she worked out. This is my aunt, Barb Moyer, who knew Iris. Iris's last name was Juarez. Detective Boone looked down at her aunt with a sympathetic frown.
Ms. Moyer, I'm very sorry for your loss. I'm glad you asked to see me, and I would have contacted you myself in a day or two at your home.
Aunt Barb sniffled. Detective, I want you to do everything possible to find out what happened here, because Iris was a wonderful person and my dearest friend, and she deserves everything that you can do for her.
I certainly will, Detective Boone nodded, setting his mouth.
He slipped his hand inside his dark sport coat and extracted a ballpoint pen and skinny notepad like Officer Hoffman carried.
Now, tell me about yourself and how you know the decedent.
Aunt Barb cleared her throat.
I'm a landscape architect, and I live in Kennett Square on Vaughan Road. Iris was my best friend, and she worked for me as a gardener and as a companion for the past 3 years or so.
Detective Boone flipped open the cardboard cover of his pad, clicked on his pen, and started taking notes. He looked over at Judy, blinking behind his aviator glasses, which were smudged.
Miss Carrier, how do you know Ms. Juarez?
I just met her today at my aunt's house.
Aunt Barb interjected.
Iris was leaving for her shift at Mike's Exotics. She works the 3 to 11. She came by this morning to bring me some cookies since my family is here for a visit.
Judy noted that Aunt Barb wasn't telling him about her cancer and respected that she wanted to keep it private. She let her aunt take the lead since she had the information. Detective Boone made another note.
Address and phone?
Her aunt gave the phone number, then answered,
Point Breeze Avenue, Point Breeze Apartments, 1C. Do you have her phone? She got a call today that concerned her and I'm curious about it.
I'll see if the phone was bagged yet.
She seemed fine when I saw her today, and she never mentioned anything about heart trouble. She's very healthy.
Do you know who her family doctor is, if she had one? Detective Boone cocked his head.
I don't think she had one. She used the LCD, but she never went unless I nagged her.
Detective Boone made another note.
Officer Hoffman tells me that you're the emergency contact, and that Miss Juarez didn't have close family or friends in the area besides you. Is that correct?
She didn't have family, but she did have a good friend, Daniela Gamboa. Somebody will have to notify her about this. I never met her, but Iris talked about her. They used to work together at Mike's Exotics, but Iris told me Daniela doesn't work there anymore.
Do you have contact info for Miss Gamboa, like an address or phone?
No.
We'll find Miss Gamboa, Detective Boone made a note. We'll conduct our investigation in the next few days and we'll keep you informed.
He turned to Judy.
Officer Hoffman mentioned to me that you're an attorney in Philadelphia, so I expect you'll be an asset.
Judy tried to believe him, but nobody liked the Philadelphia lawyer,
least of all a detective. Thank you. I know that Officer Hoffman said that the case appears to be a natural death. And I'm sure that's true, but the manner of death does appear to be natural because of the conditions of the body and the circumstances in which the body was found. Detective Boone gestured at the Honda. The facts suggest she had a heart attack while she was driving. Which fact suggests that specifically? Several. As is typical, her body was slumped forward and took pressure off the gas pedal. Then the car drifted off the road into a hayroll. The engine was running when we found the car. The fuel tank was almost out of gas. The airbag did not deploy. This was a low-speed collision. There's no injury or seatbelt marks that we could find. Judy took it in. Well, my aunt had some questions, like the phone, and also that Iris should have been at work. Aunt Barb added, she never misses work and is very diligent, so I can't for the life of me understand why she wasn't there. I see. Detective Boone made a note. I will be sure to follow up with the folks at Mike's Exotics. You know the place? Judy asked. Of course, Detective Boone smiled crookedly. East Grove isn't Philly. Judy continued. Plus, my aunt made the point that it doesn't make sense that Iris was on this road at all. Apparently, it's not on the way home from work. Aunt Barb chimed in. This is way out of her way. There's nothing around here. I can't imagine what she was doing here, can you? Detective Boone scribbled in his pad. She could have been going somewhere other than home, obviously. If she began to experience symptoms of heart attack or stroke, such as confusion or disorientation, she wouldn't know where she was driving. But that would be just speculation. Judy didn't know enough to agree or disagree with him. My aunt also made a point that her window was open, and Iris didn't like to drive with the windows open because it messed up her hair. Aunt Barb nodded. That's true, and besides which, she only had a t-shirt on, not even a sweater. Women our age don't do that. We're always cold. Detective Boone looked up from his pad. We can't assume that she died in the evening hours. We don't have the time of death yet. It's certainly possible that she passed in the daytime. It was a sunny day, so she could have had the window open. But people would have seen her and called the police. Unlikely, this road isn't well traveled, and they might not have realized she was dead. Detective Boone, there was one last detail that concerned me, which is that I noticed that Iris had a few broken nails. Aunt Barb looked up. She did? Yes, they hadn't been broken earlier today when I saw her. Judy didn't know how much more of this conversation her aunt could take. I noticed because her nail polish was unusual, red with rhinestones. I'm not sure what it means, but I wanted to mention that to you. Aunt Barb bit her lip. Iris took great care of her hands and nails. She loved to do her nails. She wore gloves when she gardened because of them. Detective Boone flipped his pad closed. I wouldn't want to speculate on the significance of someone's breaking their nails. We have four pathologists in this county, and one of them will perform an autopsy, run toxicology tests, and do whatever else they think is indicated. Aunt Barb gasped, horrified. Wait, what? You're going to do an autopsy on Iris? Yes. Detective Boone pursed his lips, and his jowls fell into sober lines. I know it's, distasteful, but it's standard procedure in a case like this. Oh, no. Aunt Barb covered her face with her hands, and Judy put her hand on her aunt's shoulder, looking at Detective Boone. Thanks for your time. I think I'll take my aunt home now. Sure. Sorry about your loss. Detective Boone gave a short wave, then turned away, and Judy walked around the VW, climbed into the driver's seat, and looked over at her aunt. I'm sorry. Thanks. Aunt Barb gave her nose a final blow. Let's get out of here. I agree. Judy put on her shoulder harness, twisted the key in the ignition, released the brake, and hit the gas, turning the car around to put the coroner's van behind them. I go straight, right? Yes, and I'll tell you when to turn left. But we went straight to get here, didn't we? Judy glanced over. I know, but we're not going home yet. Chapter 8. Where are we going? Judy asked, worried. Mike's Exotics, where Iris worked. I want to see if she went in today. I want to find out what happened.
Do you really feel up to that right now?
Yes, and I don't want to let it wait. Aunt Barb stowed her Kleenex in her pocket and straightened in the passenger seat. She would still be on shift, so they should be there. I want to talk to her boss. His name is Julio, and I met him once when I dropped her off because her car was in the shop. Aunt Barb pointed to the left. This is the turn, up ahead.
But you're tired. Maybe we should go home.
Judy spotted the break in the cornfield on the left, but there was no street sign.
No, I'm fine. And what's the point of putting it off?
You could sleep and get your feet under you emotionally. You just got blindsided in the worst possible way.
But I only have the weekend. The mastectomy is on Monday.
We can go tomorrow.
Julio might not be on the job tomorrow, and he's the one I want to talk to. I won't sleep if I don't understand what happened to her.
Aunt Barb turned her face to the window, but there was nothing to see in the dark.
What is it that you think happened?
Judy turned left onto another long country road. Bugs flew from the gloom into their headlights, making tink-tink sounds when they hit the glass.
I don't know. I only know that what I'm hearing doesn't make sense. She didn't have any heart issues.
What's the LCD you keep mentioning?
It's the health service in Kennett Square that the undocumented use.
So it can't be the best medical care, can it? She could have had heart issues and not known about it.
But she was strong and able and hardworking.
And what about the car window and the nails and the phone call, the way she acted afterwards?
Those are strange details, but they don't necessarily mean anything.
Judy regretted having brought any of it up.
It's not as if there was any sign of foul play.
I know. I'm not saying that.
Then what are you saying?
Judy asked, her tone gentle as they drove into the dark.
I'm just saying that if I can ask a few more questions so that I have answers when I put my head down on the pillow tonight, I think it makes sense to do so.
I agree. But I think Detective Boone will follow up. It's police business, and he seemed pretty good.
I think he will, too, but I'm not about to sit on my hands. Besides, since when do you care if something is police business? That never stopped you or Mary.
Except that she's getting married. Judy thought back to the day when she'd felt like Debbie Downer at the bridal shop. Our days of excellent adventures might be over. She's a partner now, too.
Don't worry. You two are thick as thieves. By the way, how are you and Frank doing?
Great, fine. Judy usually confided in her aunt, but didn't want to burden her any further, with so much already on her plate.
Thinking about getting married?
Maybe.
Take your time, there's no rush.
Sometimes when your friends get married, it puts pressure, but it shouldn't. Aunt Barb paused, musing.
Though I hated it when your mother got married before me.
Everybody knows I'm nicer. Judy smiled as they passed a dark barn with a tall blue silo.
But she's older than you. She would have hated it if you got married before her, wouldn't she have?
Honey, let me tell you, marriage was not on that girl's mind. She liked the bad boys in high school. You wouldn't know it to look at her now, but she's where you get your wild side.
Judy chuckled and thought of her mother waiting for them at home.
Aunt Barb, how long do you expect this will take? I'm trying to decide if we should let her know we'll be late.
Good point. I'll text her.
Aunt Barb reached for her purse and got the phone.
What are you going to say?
I'll tell her we're running late and not to worry is all. Aunt Barb texted away as the light from the phone screen shone upward, illuminating her laugh lines, which bracketed a sly smile.
I can get you out of anything, even ballet lessons, remember?
Of course. Judy chuckled at the memory from when she was only 6 years old. Her mother had decided that her tomboy daughter needed some civilizing and signed her up for ballet lessons, but Judy hated every minute of them. She begged to quit after the first recital, in which she starred as a dancing poodle in tiara kid makeup, a pink tutu, and a puffy pink tail. Her mother had relented and let her quit, only because Aunt Barb had prevailed upon her to let Judy take drawing lessons instead, which had led to her lifelong love of art and painting.
Aunt Barb looked over. I still remember the song from that recital. Isn't that crazy?
I remember it too. Judy decided to sing it to cheer her aunt up.
We are little dancing poodles, and we are here to say,
Aunt Barb joined in,
we come from France to do our dance, but we only do ballet.
They sang together, then laughed. Judy's throat thickened. She loved her aunt and couldn't imagine losing her, not now or ever.
I can't believe you remember that.
Are you kidding? I still have PTSD. Judy chuckled, then turned right and left, following her aunt's directions through corn and soybean fields and past horses grazing in rolling pastures, their outlines indistinct in the darkness and their whinnying cutting through the night air. The fields gave way to farmhouses and barns, then to trailers and smaller homes, until they spotted a small cast-iron sign that read, Welcome to East Grove. The town was of colonial vintage like Kennett Square, and quaint brick and clapboard houses lined the road, their wooden porches just steps from the curb. Judy headed for the outskirts of the town, past a check-cashing storefront and a shabby Mexican taqueria. Finally, they came upon a long, low series of square buildings, only one story high, mere cinder-block boxes attached in a row like railroad cars. They had no windows, so there was no way to tell if anyone was inside, and the only light came from flickering fixtures on the roofs of the buildings, which cast jittery cones of light on the worn asphalt lot. Here's Mike's. Aunt Barb gestured at the driveway that had no sign, except for private property, no through traffic.
That's the parking lot.
Why no sign? Judy steered into the lot, where there were a few old cars parked in a row.
Everybody knows where Mike's is. He's one of the tiny independent growers. He owns about 10 other growers, all independent. He produces exotics.
What's exotics? Judy turned off the ignition and put on the emergency brake, looking through the windshield and noticing for the first time that the buildings had large numbers painted on the cinder block in black. The building on the end, closest to them, was number 7.
Fancier mushrooms, portobello, maitake, shiitake, cremini. But he hires the undocumented.
How does he get away with it? What about immigration?
The way the system works is that immigration stages a raid only if there's a significant number of complaints in relation to the size of the workforce. Bottom line, nobody complains.
Aunt Barb picked up her water bottle and took a sip of water.
Immigration isn't the real problem anyway, the IRS is. If a grower submits a list of Social Security numbers and they're not good, it takes the IRS 3 months to figure that out. So in 3 months, after the grower gets the IRS notice, he fires the employees and they go to another grower or another location of the same grower, like Mike's.
Really?
That's how it worked with Iris. She worked at all of his locations for about a year now.
Aunt Barb eyed the buildings.
It's like a shell game, because even workers with legitimate green cards have only 6 months in the country. Then they have to go back. They worry they can't get back in, but plenty of them do. And they end up at one of the shadier growers.
Was Iris afraid of being caught?
She worried about it constantly. She lived in fear of being deported, always looking over her shoulder. You saw her. She was so quiet. She learned to be invisible.
Aunt Barb paused and her eyes glistened anew.
There are so many undocumented workers here and everywhere.
But that doesn't make it right.
Judy believed in the law, even if it meant siding with her mother. I know, but they're here, living in a parallel universe. They're an open secret.
Judy thought of the undocumented workers she'd seen in the city, the busboys smoking outside the back door of the restaurants, or the men who delivered her takeout pizza by bicycle. We know and we don't know.
Yes. And the interesting thing about an open secret is that people look the other way. Literally. Iris became the kind of woman whom people looked away from, unmemorable and marginalized, even more than the average middle-aged woman.
Judy could hear the resentment in her aunt's voice.
Where did she work before Mike's?
She cleaned houses for that service, which is when I met her, as I told you. She also did yard work and she washed and mended horse blankets. At one point, she worked 3 jobs.
Judy slid the keys from the ignition.
Okay, so why are we here?
You'll see. I have a plan. Just follow my lead.
Aunt Barb reached for the door handle, and Judy wondered when it got to be so hard to keep up with someone almost twice her age. Chapter 9.
So what's your plan? Judy took her aunt's arm, but she needed no help, standing straight and tall, her step fueled by a new determination.
To see the boss and get to the bottom of this, that's what. Iris works here, and she should have been here tonight.
Aunt Barb gestured at the cinderblock buildings.
These are the growing rooms, and the packing area and office are behind them.
Judy grimaced at the disgusting odor of manure that permeated the air.
They really use manure to grow mushrooms?
Yes, horse manure and some chicken, but they call it compost. That's why there's always mushroom growers next to horse farms. Chester County produces almost half of all mushrooms grown in the United States.
Really? How do you know that?
Everybody does. It's a source of local pride. And Iris used to tell me all about the business, and she would give me the inside track.
But how did she work with the smell?
Judy couldn't imagine anyone breathing that stink 24/7.
God knows. Her aunt wrinkled her nose. The men pick the mushrooms and the women pack. But it's gross in the packing room here, too.
Judy didn't know much about how mushrooms grew, except it had been a joke at her old law firm that the partners treated the associates like mushrooms. Keep them in the dark and feed them shit.
How is that sanitary to grow food in horse manure?
They pasteurize it. You'll see. We'll go inside. Aunt Barb charged past battered trash cans and broken wooden pallets.
This place is such a dump. I don't know how they pass inspection.
Who inspects? Judy asked as they approached the door to the building.
The state and federal agencies and the mushroom growers have their own independent council that inspects as well.
Someday I'll figure out how Mike gets away with what he does. Aunt Barb reached for the metal handle on the battered door, which had a thick spring.
He must pay somebody off.
I'll get the door, Judy said. But her aunt had already opened it, and they entered the building where the manure stink was stronger, turning Judy's stomach. They found themselves in a cold, rectangular hallway with a grimy gray utility sink and blue plastic trays scattered on a concrete floor.
It's so chilly in here.
Because we're close to the growing rooms.
Let's keep going. The office is behind the growing rooms.
I got the door. Judy crossed to another door, also with a metal handle and a spring. Wrinkled paper signs were taped to the door in English and Spanish. Hairnets must be worn. Veracia debe usarse en esta área. No smoking, eating, or drinking in this area. Prohibido fumar, comer o beber en esta área. This is a growing room, her aunt said, charging through the door into the freezing cold dark room that reeked of manure. A mechanical thrumming filled the air, the sound of refrigeration units atop the building. Judy followed, but the stench of manure overpowered her, triggering her gag reflex. Her steps slowed and she covered her mouth instinctively, trying not to throw up. She could barely see a thing, and the room was dark, except for a single bare fluorescent panel on one of the wooden racks of brown mushrooms, which ran the length of the immense room, almost floor to ceiling. Narrow aisles ran between the racks, and as her eyes adjusted to the darkness, she could make out the dim outline of 20-some figures moving up and down the aisles, hunched over the trays. She walked past, shuddering against the cold, her eyes tearing from the manure stink. They looked like shadows instead of people, but they were men dressed for the frigid temperatures in heavyweight hoodies and bulky jeans, with baseball caps over their puffy white paper hairnets. None of them looked up, but stayed face down as they picked small brown mushrooms from trays of thousands, seeming not to see or hear her. She realized that they all had earplugs in against the mechanical noise. Judy felt so disturbed by what she was seeing that she found her pace quicken. She couldn't have imagined such awful working conditions worse than hell itself because of the manure. She caught up with her aunt, who was at a door in the back wall with more Spanish and English signs, then one in a language she didn't recognize.
Tolong tangan halangi pintu. Do not block door.
Judy placed a hand on her aunt's back.
Go, please. I can't take the smell.
Aunt Barb opened the door.
This must be the packing room. Judy followed her into the massive cold room, filled with manure smell and mechanical noise. She blinked against the sudden brightness from fluorescent panels suspended from a grimy, corrugated ceiling, illuminating 20-odd women working at a long assembly line, packing mushrooms behind a wall of heavy machinery that had huge rolls of plastic wrap. Her aunt hurried ahead, but Judy slowed to take it in, imagining poor Iris working here. None of the women looked up, their ears plugged against the refrigeration noise, breathing in the manure smell. They were white, Hispanic, and Asian, all dressed in dark blue smocks over hoodies and wool hats over hairnets, packing mushrooms into light blue containers, positioning them in the wrapping machines, stamping them, and placing them in large, unmarked cardboard boxes. The humans worked like robots, part of the assembly line itself, and the job horrified Judy as much as the growing room. She hurried ahead to keep up with Aunt Barb, past a time clock with yellow cards and trays, and reached a scuffed swinging door, pushed it open, and entered a short hallway leading to some sort of office. That was awful. Judy took a deep breath, but the air was still smelly. She felt vaguely ashamed at herself for beefing about the asbestos damages cases, but she knew that wouldn't stop her. Finally, the office. Let me do the talking. Aunt Barb flagged down an overweight man who looked to be in his mid-30s, lumbering down the paneled hall toward them, a confused frown folding his fleshy face. His hair was a sparse brown, and he had on a light blue Oxford shirt, loose tan work pants, and worn black sneakers. "Ladies," he waved back at them, "may I help you? The public isn't allowed in the..." "I'm sorry, but we're looking for Julio," Aunt Barb answered as they reached the man. "He's the boss, right? Or is Mike around?" "They're not here. I'm Scott Panic, Assistant Operations Manager. What can I do for you?" "Scott, my name is Barb Moyer. This is my niece Judy, and I'm a friend of Iris Juarez, who works here. I'm sorry, I don't know who you're talking about." Scott folded his arms over his chubby belly. "Look, I know that Iris worked here. She's been working here for 2 months on the 3-to-11 shift in the packing room. She should have been working tonight." "No, you have your facts wrong." Scott shook his head, sticking out his lower lip. "I don't know any Iris Juarez. Nobody works here by that name." Judy held her tongue only because her aunt wanted to do the talking. "Scott," her aunt said calmly, "I know she worked here. She started 2 months ago. I dropped her off here 2 weeks ago." "I'm sorry, but I can't help you. I don't know what you're talking about." "I know she worked here. I picked her up here, too, the same day. That was when I met, or at least saw, Julio." Judy interjected. "Scott, we're not from immigration or the IRS or anything. We're just personal friends of Iris's, trying to figure out what happened to her. I don't know if you heard, but she was found dead in her car today on Brandywine Way."
"Oh, no." Scott's eyes flared, his surprise genuine. "Oh, geez. I'm sorry to hear that."
"Me too," Aunt Barb sighed. Whether from relief or fatigue, Judy couldn't tell.
"Okay, so now we know. She worked here."
"Yes, she did." Scott buckled his lower lip. "I didn't know who you were. Well, you know."
"I know. The police think she had a heart attack. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of it because she should have been at work tonight."
Scott hesitated, rubbing his face.
"Yes, to be honest, she should have been here, but she didn't come in today."
"So you didn't see her today at all?"
"No, she was a no-show."
Scott shrugged his heavy shoulders sadly.
"It's not like her, but then again, you never know."
"Did you call her when you realized she wasn't here?"
"No, I never do. I figured she moved on. They move around a lot and usually don't say where they're going. One day they just disappear."
Judy remained silent. Nobody had to ask whom he meant by they.
That wouldn't be like her either, just to disappear without saying so.
Barb seemed to slump in her parka, and Judy could feel her leaning on her arm for support.
"No, it wouldn't. But I didn't change what I usually do." Scott's face fell into lines. "Iris really is, or was, a special person. My wife and I just had our second baby, and she brought in cookies for me to bring home. Aunt Barb smiled sadly. That would be Iris, to a T. I didn't know she had heart problems. She didn't, that I know of. That's what I'm trying to figure out, that and why she was on Brandywine Way. You have any idea why she would be down there? No, not at all. There's nothing there. Scott frowned, puzzled. She was friends with Daniela Gamboa, and I think Daniela used to work here, didn't she? Yeah, but she left. Do you know why? No idea. Like I say, they come and go. One day last week, she didn't show up. Judy interjected. Was Iris friendly with any of the other women in the packing room? Scott shook his head. No, there's so much moving around. They don't even know each other's names, and that's the way they like it. The only exception is when the families come up together, like cousins will work together and they stick together. But I never saw Iris with any of them. Judy got another idea. Did she have a locker or anything we could look through? Maybe it would contain something that would help us? No, Scott answered. Like I say, there's so many changes in the workforce, we don't give them lockers. Only management has lockers. The employees keep their things in their cars or their fanny packs. They're big on fanny packs. Judy made a mental note. Scott, do you know who her doctor might have been? No, I assume she used the LCD. Most of them do. Judy remembered that Aunt Barb had said the same thing. Did she ever say she didn't feel well at work? No, never. She never missed a day, and she took all the extra shifts I could give her. She was a workhorse. They all are. They never complain. They're the best workers you'd ever had, the Mexicans. Judy didn't know whether to be offended because his tone was so favorable. Scott smiled crookedly. You're looking at me funny. You must not be from around here. No, Judy said, feeling her face flush. I'm trying to wrap my head around the use of these undocumented workers. It's an open secret. Scott nodded. Ah, absolutely. But I don't think we're that different from a lot of other places in the country. I'd love to hire Americans, but they don't want to pick mushrooms. It's filthy, smelly work. We advertise on Craigslist, Monster, everywhere, but nobody applies. We pay minimum wage, too, so it's not like we're exploiting anybody. Scott opened his palms in uneasy appeal. Listen, you have to be realistic. We need the labor, and the Mexicans are happy to have the work. Let me ask you one question. Judy was still trying to understand. We were at the scene tonight where Iris was found, and the police said they'll follow up with you about her. Will you confirm that she worked here, or will you try to keep it quiet like you did with us? No, we cooperate with the East Grove police. They get it. Don't they report you for hiring undocumented workers? Do you ever get raided? We don't get raided because nobody files a complaint, and the local police tend not to give us too much trouble. Scott glanced over at the clock on the wall. Well, I better get back to the floor. Can I show you ladies out? Yes, thanks. Judy put an arm around her aunt, who looked suddenly thoughtful. Come with me. Scott motioned toward a brown metal door near the office area. And please accept my condolences. Iris was a very special lady, and we'll say a prayer for her tonight. Yes, thanks, Aunt Barb said quietly. Good night. After you, Aunt Barb. Judy opened the door to let her aunt out, and they walked together toward the car. I think we need to text your mother again. We'll tell her we decided to go out for an ice cream sundae. What? Aren't you tired yet? Judy chuckled in surprise. Hell no. Her aunt pulled out her knit cap and shoved her hands deep in her pockets. I'm just getting started. Chapter 10. Judy pulled up, cut the ignition, and looked around. The apartment complex where Iris lived was too run down to be well lighted, and the only light came from the street lamp, which dimly illuminated a large square parking lot that seemed to be the focal point of the apartments, a connected series of two-story buildings wrapped in a U-shape around the lot. Old cars filled the parking spaces, some with missing hubcaps and others with dented doors, and the lights from the apartments showed people leaning on the cars and sitting on their front steps or on plastic beach chairs, visible only in silhouette, laughing, talking, or smoking, the red tips of their cigarettes glowing in the dark. Judy, you ready to go? Judy looked over. Sure, but what are we trying to accomplish again? I told you, you're not going to talk me out of this. I have one day of freedom left. Even if the police follow up, there's things they might miss. They didn't know Iris the way I know her. And I'm sure the roommates will be much happier talking to me than the local constabulary.
On it. Judy pulled the key out of the ignition, and they both got out of the car and walked to the driveway of the apartment complex, where she took her aunt's arm.
I can walk, you know.
Aunt Barb's gaze slid slyly to Judy under her knit cap.
My legs are fine. It's my breasts that are the problem.
Yes, but if I hold your breast, people will talk, and Aunt Barb laughed.
Look around you. They already are.
Judy looked at stoops and beach chairs where heads were turning. The residence had grown quiet as the two women made their way down the center of the square parking area, and a short man nearest them flicked his cigarette into the air, where it arced like a falling star.
It's because we're gringas, Aunt Barb said, lowering her voice. By the way, do you like my accent?
Nice. How good is your Spanish?
Let's put it this way. Your mom is the linguist, not me, but I understand it better than I can speak it.
Which apartment did you say it was again?
This one, right here.
Her aunt turned right between two parked cars and walked until they reached a path of cracked concrete that served as an interior sidewalk. Aunt Barb, do you realize they might not know about Iris's death?
I know. I'll do the talking, okay?
Fine with me. You're on a roll. Judy squeezed her arm, and they turned onto a crumbling concrete path that led to the front door of one of the buildings. Everyone on the step where the beach chairs fell silent, and in the lights from inside the first-floor apartments, Judy could see that they were younger than she had realized, maybe in their 20s and 30s, a group of men and women, all of them Hispanic, in an array of T-shirts, sweatshirts, and jeans. Her aunt stopped short in the middle of the path.
Hello. My name is Barb Moyer, and this is my niece Judy. I'm a friend of Iris's. I'm here to see her roommates, Maria Elena or Amenia.
I'm Maria Elena, said one of the women, in slightly accented English. She was sitting in a beach chair holding a phone and wearing a white sweatshirt and jeans, but it was too dark to see her facial features. She sounded young, and her long, glossy curls shone in the light from the window.
Maria Elena, would you mind if we went inside and talked a minute about Iris?
She's not home.
I know, I'm a friend of hers and...
Oh, wait, I know who you are. Maria Elena's tone warmed up. You're the lady with the roses. Iris told me about you.
Yes, that's me.
What about Iris?
Aunt Barb hesitated. I'm afraid I have bad news. I'm very sorry, but I'm here to tell you that she has, passed. She was found tonight in her car on Brandywine Way. Maria Elena gasped, and everyone burst into shocked Spanish chatter, and Judy caught the words muerte and accidente. Her aunt said,
No, not a car accident. They think she had a heart attack.
No, Maria Elena moaned, and another wave of chatter went through the crowd, which grew somber, and an older man made the sign of the cross on his chest.
Do you think we can go inside? There's just some things I want to talk to you about.
Sure, of course. Maria Elena rose, made her way through the crowd, and led them to the front door and inside the building. They walked down a long, dimly lighted hall, and at the end was a door which Maria Elena unlocked and pushed open, flicking on a stark overhead light.
Come in, please.
Thank you, Aunt Barb responded, and they entered a neat, if small, living room that was modestly furnished with an old brown couch, a red plaid chair, and a wooden rocker set around a battered coffee table. A tiny galley kitchen was on the right part of the room, but there was no dining room table, and two closed doors off the room presumably led to the bedrooms.
I can't believe this happened. Are you sure it's true? Maria Elena frowned sadly, pocketing her keys.
In the bright light, Judy could see that her warm brown eyes had filmed, dampening her mascara'd lashes. She was pretty with a small nose and heart-shaped lips, slick with gloss.
Yes, it's true, her aunt answered. I'm so sorry. The police came to me because she has my name as her emergency contact.
So she's really dead?
Maria Elena sank onto the plaid chair, linking her fingers between her knees, absorbing the shock.
Her nails were polished red with white chevrons at the squared-off tips, reminding Judy again of Iris's broken fingernail. Yes, it's true. I identified her. That's terrible. Maria Elena shook her head numbly and wiped her eyes. This makes me so sad. That hurts my heart. I'm so sorry. And her family at home? It's all gone? Yes. Do you know Daniela Gamboa? I meet her once or twice. Do you have her cell phone or address? No. Maria Elena sniffed, brushing a tear away before it started to spill down her cheek. Iris is so quiet, like to herself, and she is so sweet. She had such a sweet heart. She's older, you know. She acts like my mother. She's always baking cookies and cakes to get us to eat, and she's so religious all the time. She wants us to go to church with her. She says we drink too much beer. She tells us, like, all the time. Maria Elena wagged her finger with a mock comic frown.
Ladies should not drink too much, never out of the bottle. She wants us to make germamentos.
Judy interjected. What does that mean?
It's a special thing, like you go to church with her and make a promise to God that we don't drink for like 2 weeks.
Maria Elena chuckled.
She wants us to, anyway, but we don't do it.
How long have you lived together? Aunt Barb asked, but she was beginning to sound tired again.
About 6 months. She take us both in. Her other roommates go home. Me and Armenia, she's out with her boyfriend. Iris meets us at the mission and she takes us in. She gets us jobs.
Judy interjected again. What's the mission?
You know, the church mission. They give out clothes and toys for free.
Her aunt asked, do you know why she didn't go to work today? When she left my house this afternoon, that's where she said she was going. Maria Elena shook her head, blinking away her new tears.
No, I don't know.
I worked the morning shift today and she's gone when I get home. Aunt Barb asked, do you work at Mike's too?
Not anymore. I work in a restaurant and I clean houses.
Maria Elena wrinkled her pretty nose.
I don't want to do the mushrooms anymore, even though they pay good. That smell, I can't take it. It gets on your clothes and your hair.
Maria Elena turned to Judy.
You know what I'm saying? You can't get the stink out. It's like on you, like all the time. I won't have no boyfriend if I smell like that. That's why Iris used the perfume so much.
Her aunt asked, Maria Elena, was Iris sick lately? Did she mention anything about her chest hurting or not feeling well?
No.
Do you know who Iris uses for a doctor? Does she have a doctor?
I guess she goes to LCD, but I don't know.
Do you know any reason why she'd be on Brandywine Way? Do you know where that is?
I know where that is. I don't know, like, why she was there.
Maria Elena tossed her head and her curls bounced. Did you text her today?
No.
Do you mind if I go in her room? I just want to look around and see if there's anything to explain why she missed work today. Aunt Barb emitted a small sigh. I should get some clothes to bury her in.
All right. Maria Elena rose. Come on.
Thanks, Aunt Barb said. And they crossed the living room to the kitchen side, where Maria Elena opened the door onto a room that was barely big enough for a single bed, neatly made with a blue comforter and a beat-up fake wood chest of drawers. A pair of old pink flip-flops sat beside the bed on the floor, ready and waiting for a woman who would never come home.
She has the smallest room, that's why she doesn't share. Maria Elena tried to press the door open all the way, but it banged into the wall. We share. Also, it works out better because she doesn't stay out late like us.
They entered the tiny room, barely able to fit the three of them, with Judy feeling strange, having just come from seeing Iris's lifeless body on the stretcher. A large crucifix hung on white walls, and the dresser held an old-fashioned runner of white cotton, on which rested a few bottles of nail polish, perfume, a ceramic statue of the Virgin Mary, a plastic white crucifix, a multicolored clay plate that held gold-toned hoops and necklaces, and a yellow shaker of athlete's foot powder.
Where's the closet? Aunt Barb asked, turning on her heel.
But Maria Elena shook her head.
She don't have one.
Where does she put her dresses?
In the drawer. She only has two dresses that she wears to church.
But that can't be. I gave her dresses and sweaters and shirts, too. Jewelry. Aunt Barb frowned, puzzled, looking around. I don't see any of the stuff I gave her here. There were shoes and rain boots, too. Maria Elena shook her head. I don't know. Maybe she give them to the mission. She's always after me to give my things to the mission, too. When I meet her at the mission the first day, she isn't there to get. She's there to give. She always says, Maria Elena, God wants you to take care of people. But I tell her, Iris, it's not like I have so much. She wants us to give our money to the mission, too. Maria Elena's eyes flared open incredulous. I tell her, Mommy, you can give your money away, but me, no. God don't want me broke.
Oh, my, what a wonderful spirit she had. Aunt Barb rested a hand on the dresser, seeming to steady herself. Judy, can you look through these drawers and find a nice dress for her?
Sure. Judy went to the dresser and opened the top drawer, which contained folded underwear, bras, and a Bible. Do we need underwear?
No, funeral homes usually have that.
Good. Judy opened the second drawer of neatly folded t-shirts that looked as if they had been ironed, which for some reason caught her in the throat.
I don't think there's anything useful in here.
I help.
Maria Elena squeezed past Judy, went to the dresser and opened the third drawer.
I know the dress she liked the most.
Thanks.
Judy looked into the third drawer, which held pressed jeans, sweatpants, and two folded shift-type dresses, both a flowered pattern, with a light blue sweater also carefully folded.
This one.
Maria Elena picked up a dress with pink flowers, her eyes glistening anew.
Thank you.
Judy accepted the clothes and took a look at her aunt's heartbroken expression, which told her it was time to go home, and that their questions about Iris's death would have to be answered another day. Chapter 11. They hit the road in silence, with Judy following GPS directions home, and her aunt turned away to the window. They wound through the dark outskirts of Kennett Square, passing check-cashing agencies, a taqueria, and a Mexican restaurant until they reached the town proper, with its charming brick houses, mullioned windows, and gas streetlights. A quiet sniffle came from the passenger seat, and Judy patted her aunt's arm.
I love you, Aunt Barb. I'm sorry about Iris.
Thanks, her aunt said, without turning her head from the window. She sounds like she really was an amazing person, giving everything away.
I know. I had no idea. I always wondered what she did with the money she earned, because I know she didn't have anybody to send money home to.
Aunt Barb sniffled again.
I guess she kept what she needed to live on and gave the rest to the mission. What a wonderful person.
I'll say.
Thanks for indulging me, too. I don't know why I'm running us ragged tonight. I guess it was so I didn't have to think about the fact that she was...
Aunt Barb's voice trailed off, and in the sudden silence, the GPS said, "Prepare to make a left turn in 100 feet." Judy switched into the left lane, ready to make the turn, and it occurred to her that life should come with a GPS, to tell you to prepare for the twists and turns on the way, big ones or little ones, like that a beloved aunt would have cancer, or your boyfriend would forget to drop the dog off to get flea-dipped, or that 75 asbestos cases would come from New York to suck the life from your practice. The trip through the growing room at the mushroom farm made the damages cases look like a first-world problem. But problems were problems.
It doesn't make sense, but death never makes sense.
Aunt Barb rummaged in her parka pocket and produced her balled-up Kleenex.
In a way, it was just like Steve. Even though I knew he was going to die, I still couldn't believe it when it happened. Just like her, he was so vital and healthy. He did everything right. I remember.
Judy had loved her uncle, an accountant. A reserved and careful man, he taught her chess. Not only the game itself, but the exotic names of the various openings, like the Sicilian Defense and the Queen's Gambit, as well as chess notation, which was like some mysterious language that only they spoke. NE4, NGE7. Judy always got special attention from her uncle and aunt, because she was their only niece, and they'd never had children of their own.
I'm feeling him tonight, too. Maybe that's why I went crazy running hither and yon. It's funny when you get older. One death kicks up all the other deaths.
I bet that's right. Judy noted that her aunt hadn't mentioned the possibility of her own death, though it had to be uppermost in her mind. Aunt Barb blew her nose. I guess we can't really know what Iris was doing today. It seems strange that she didn't tell me, though. She never lied to me before.
She didn't lie to you exactly, did she? You just assumed she was going to work, but she didn't go to work.
That's true, but still. Like the clothes and shoes you gave her, you didn't know she was giving them to the mission. You just assumed she kept them.
Yes, that's true, too, Aunt Barb nodded.
So what do you think she was doing then on Brandywine Way?
We don't know enough about her life to say. Maybe somebody told her they had some stuff for the mission, so she went to pick it up before work. That's possible.
Judy heard herself say it. The detective will let us know, but I'm thinking that the police probably took her cell phone. That's how they found the wallet and came to your house.
Oh, right. And like the cops said, fingernails break all the time. And because it was a nice day, she decided to drive with the window open. All of that is completely possible.
I suppose so. But I want to see what the police come up with, don't you?
Yes. Judy didn't mention the autopsy, but she didn't need to.
You know, the most ironic thing is that Iris was so worried about me with my cancer. She wanted me to go to church with her tomorrow morning to say a prayer before the mastectomy.
That's very sweet, Judy said, meaning it. The GPS was about to tell her to turn left, but she turned it off. I'm going to go myself and say a prayer for her, and I suppose I should talk to the priest and arrange for her burial.
You're going to the Spanish church?
Yes.
Judy turned left.
I'll go with you.
You don't have to.
I know, but I want to.
Thanks.
Her aunt looked over with a smile, her wan face barely illuminated. And then there's only one more thing I want to do before Monday morning for Iris.
What's that?
I want to plant a rose bush for her. I have a cutting that came in the mail from the nursery, and we were going to put it in together on Sunday.
I'll help you do that, too, Judy said, touched.
Her aunt was always thoughtful, her actions straight from the heart. Judy would never forget that when it was time to outfit her dorm room at college, she and her mother had gone shopping for all of the practical items. A small refrigerator, a microwave, a mesh hamper, and a pair of flip-flops to prevent athlete's foot in the showers. But Aunt Barb had taken Judy antiquing, and together they'd found a beautiful old quilt, hand-stitched in a flower garden pattern, that made the dorm room homey. That very quilt was still at the foot of her bed to this day.
Thanks, honey.
It would be my pleasure, Aunt Barb. Judy turned onto her aunt's street, cruised past the houses and turned into the driveway and cut the ignition. The dashboard clock read 10:48, so she knew her mother would be waiting up, probably tapping her foot.
God, I'm tired.
Why don't you go up to bed and I'll deal with my mother? It'll take a law degree to survive the cross-examination we're about to get.
Aunt Barb chuckled and picked up her purse.
I'll be right in. I have to get the cutting from the garage and bring it in the house. It would probably be fine, but it's supposed to be cold tonight, and I don't want to lose it.
I'll get it. Tell me where it is.
You don't mind?
Believe me, I'm getting the easier job. You deal with my mother. I'll deal with the plant.
Judy yanked the key from the ignition and grabbed her purse.
Meanwhile, I don't even know what a cutting looks like. Is it big?
No, not at all. It's just a cane. It should still be in the box from the nursery. I didn't take it out.
What's a cane?
A cane is a term for the stem on a rose bush.
Ah, of course it is.
Her aunt snorted, opening the car door. Like a lawyer has the right to complain about obscure terminology.
Okay, a fair point.
Judy got out of the car, chirped it closed, and cleared her head with a lungful of fresh, cool air.
She glanced at the house and saw through the window that the living room was empty.
She must be upstairs already. You want me to come in and be your lawyer?
Ha! I can handle my own sister.
Her aunt took out her keys, unlocked the door, and handed the set to Judy. Take this. You need them to unlock the garage. It's the little key with the red surround. Can you lock it when you're finished?
Sure. You lock the garage in this neighborhood?
It was Iris's idea, after I got the electric mower. She heard people were stealing equipment, so I figured it was better to be safe than sorry.
Right.
So what am I looking for? A cardboard box near some gardening equipment? Exactly. I think I put it on the far wall next to the tools. You'll see that I have the blue carryall and Iris has the purple. I think it's in between them. I wanted it as far from the door as possible to avoid the draft. The light switch will be on your right side when you go in. Got it. Good luck with Mom. Child's play. Ha. Judy led her aunt inside the house, then turned and continued down the driveway, the gravel crunching under her clogs. Weariness washed over her, and she slid her phone from her purse and checked the screen to see if Frank had called, but he hadn't, which was par for the course. She was always the one doing the calling, making sure he was on track to come home, to meet her, or to run errands. If they got married and had a baby, it would be redundant. A motion detector light went on when she reached the garage, and she found the red key, unlocked the handle, and pulled the old metal door upward, rattling in its tracks. Her aunt's yellow Mini Cooper sat parked in the darkness, and Judy went to the right door jamb, fumbled for the switch, and turned it on. A bright fluorescent panel in the ceiling came to